We are holding on Lamed Beis Amud Aleph, beginning the fourth perek of our Masechta. So now that we dealt with the composition of a Beis Din, which was the first perek, and in the second perek we digressed about a Kohen Gadol and a king, and a third perek we talked about the procedures in Beis Din for Dinim Mamonos, basically. So now we're continuing. Now we're going to start talking about the contrast between Dinim Mamonos and Dinim Nefashos, and later on in the perek we're going to start getting into the details of how the beginning of the details of how they judge Dinim Nefashos. So the Mishnah says, "Echad dinim mamonis ve'echad dinim nefashis v'drisho v'chakira." Whether it comes to dinim mamonis or dinim nefashis, either way, Beis Din has to do drisho v'chakira. Now we learned in the previous perek, and we're going to learn in more detail later on in our perek, that there are two types of questions that Beis Din asks the Eidim. There are questions called chakirois, which are meant to establish the basic information, the time and place of the thing that they're saying happened, what day, what year, and what location, and things like that. Then we have then there's bedikas, which is where they ask them various side questions that don't directly impinge on the thing. For example, what clothes were they wearing? So now the Mishnah is saying both when it comes to Dinim Mamonos and Dinim Nefashos, there needs to be Drish v'Chakira. They have to do this investigation. They have to cross-examine them to make sure that what they're saying is valid. Shenema, because the Pasuk says, Mishpat Echad Yilachem, the Pasuk says there should be one judgment for you. Now, since in connection with Dinim Nefashos, the Torah tells us, v'darashta v'chakarta, you have to investigate and you have to cross-examine. So therefore, we learn that the same thing is by Dinim Mamonos as well. Now, having talked about that similarity, though, there are a number of differences. Ma ben dinim mamonis le dinim nefashis. Then what is the difference with what are the differences between dinim mamonis and dinim nefashis? Meaning, Tosfos says, when it comes to Hakiro, Jerisha, then because of that pasuk, Mishpat yela, echad yelachem, so we need that careful cross-examination. But we have a number of other points where there's a difference, because when it comes to dinim mamonis, we of course, we want to make sure to judge truthfully, but we want to make we also we don't need to make sure. I mean, we do need to make sure that we judge truthfully, of course, but we don't need to go the extra mile to make sure to exonerate the guy if in fact he is guilty and has to pay. Because after all, you know, if it does come out there was a mistake, they can always undo it, as we're going to talk about later in the Perek, as opposed to Dinim Nefashos, they can't. So they have to make extra sure. And the Pasuk already says that point, that they have to be extra sure to try and exonerate him in every way possible. And therefore, all the distinctions that we're going to learn in our Mishnah, there are going to be 10 of them, apply only to Dinim. There's a difference in them between Dinim Mamonos and Dinim Nefashos. So the first difference is Dinim Mamonos v'Shloisha or Dinim Nefashos v'Esrim v'Shloisha. The first difference we learned in the first parak already. Dinim Mamonos, you need only three Dayanim. Dinim Nefashos, you need 23. Because as we said, you have to have at least 10 that are able to look for reasons to exonerate him. And there can also be another 10 who are looking for reasons to convict him. And then you have an extra three in order to have the supermajority that we talked about there. Next one, dinim mamonis ben l'schus ben l'choiva. Dinim mamonis, we can begin by arguing either l'schus or l'choiva. When we start the discussion, we can start by saying, we can start with whichever one we want. Meaning, in other words, we can start by saying, well, we have a case over here where Reuven is claiming that Shimon owes him money. So let's start, they can say basically, well, let's start by dealing with the question, does he in fact owe him the money? Or if they want, they can say, let's start with the question, does he maybe not owe him the money? They can start either way, as opposed to dinim nefashos. When it comes to dinim nefashos, they have to start by making a statement that implies that the defendant may be innocent, as we'll see at the bottom of the next amud how exactly they do that. In poskhan l'choiva, they can't start with a statement that would imply that he's guilty. Next, dinim mamonis, al pi echad. When it comes to dinim mamonis, then we can decide based on a majority of one. As we learned in the first parak, you have, let's say, a Beis Din of three, two of them say that he has to pay, one of them says that not, or vice versa, then we decide it like that. We don't need a super majority. Bein l'schus, bein l'choiva, whether it's to make him pay, for example, or not. The dinin nefashos matin api echad l'schus. When it comes to dinin nefashos, a simple majority of one is enough to exonerate him and let him go free. But if we want to have if we to convict him, we need a majority of at least two, like we discussed then. Now we also learned in the first parak, a Beis Din is generally an odd number. So how are we going to have a majority of two anyway? We brought two possibilities over there. One could be where the Beis Din, let's say the Beis Din originally consisted of 23, like it's supposed to. Suppose of the 23 Dayanim, one of them says, I don't know. I can see both sides of it, and I can't decide whether to convict him or not. So then we have 11 against 11, and one of them and one of them is as if he wasn't there. Actually, even if it's not deadlocked, 11 to 11, even if it was a whole bunch of them are saying that he's guilty, but nevertheless, we have one saying any Yedea, we can't count him, therefore we need to add another two Dayanim. Now we have 24, and now it's possible for there to be, there has to be at least 23 for Dinin Nefashis. So now we have 24, so therefore it's possible to have a majority of two. They can end up breaking 13 to 11 and convict him. The other possibility we mentioned in the first parak, Rabbi Yehuda holds the Sanhedrin Gdola is 70, not like the Chacham said 71. So according to him, you can also have, it's an even number, so it's also possible to have a majority of two, 36 to 34. Anyway, so by Dinin Nefashis, you need that kind of extra, that kind of super majority to L'choiva to convict him, whereas by Dinin Nefashis, by Dinin Mominus, you don't. Next, dinim mamonis machzirin bein l'schus bein l'choiva. When it comes to dinim mamonis, we can come back, we can undo the case and rejudge it, whether it's l'schus or l'choiva. We learned in the previous parak, you can have, for example, Beis Din decided the case, then they realized there was a mistake. Now, we talked about at the end of the previous parak, for example, that one of them brings Eidos, brings Edom or Araya to undo the case, but you can also have where they realize they made a mistake in halacha. So then it doesn't matter whether they realize their mistake is in favor of one or in favor of the other. Either way, they can undo it and rejudge it. As opposed to Dinin Nefashis, Dinin Nefashis Machzirin L'Schus Ve'in Machzirin L'Choiva. When it comes to Dinin Nefashis, if they realize afterwards, before the guy is executed, that he shouldn't be, that we actually have evidence to say that he's innocent after all, then we do that, we bring him back to Beis Din, and we rejudge it, as we're going to discuss the details of that in the sixth parak. But Ve'in Machzirin L'Choiva, we don't bring him back to convict him, meaning even if they made a mistake and wrongly exonerated him, then nevertheless, that's it. We still keep him, he still goes free, and we can't return him and convict him. So that's another difference between Dinin Nefashis and Dinin Mamonis. Next one, Dinin Mamonis HaKol Melamdin Schus V'Choiva. When it comes to Dinin Mamonis, anybody can declare, I have a reason to declare him innocent, or I have a reason to declare him guilty and liable. Meaning Rashi says, even the Talmidim, you have the Beis Din would always have Talmidim sitting in front of them. Eventually, as we're going to learn later on in the Perek, those Talmidim would actually be, they would also serve as a pool of potential Dayanim if they need to. First of all, we said you can have a case where Beis Din of 23 needs to have people added to it if one of the Dayanim says any Yedea, but you can also have a case one of the Dayanim passed away, or you have various other possibilities. So you have a pool, the Talmidim over there, first of all, they're sitting partial to learn Torah, to learn how a din Torah is judged, but also they serve as a pool from which they can take new Dayanim if necessary. So now we're saying, even those Talmidim, if they're sitting over there watching a case of Dinim Mamonis being judged, and one of them says, I have what to speak up, and say that I have a point in favor or against this guy, a point that the Dayanim themselves don't realize, then that's fine, they can do that. Dinin Nefashis, HaKol Melamdin Schus, Ve'en HaKol Melamdin Choiva. On the other hand, when it comes to Dinin Nefashis, the Talmidim have the right to speak up when it's going to be to make the person, to declare the person innocent, but not to declare him guilty. So if there's a point, if there's a consideration that would call it where the Dayanim are thinking to judge him guilty, and one of the Talmidim realizes, hey, you know, there's a certain drasha from a posik or something or some detail that we can show to impeach the Edim's testimony, then he can speak up and mention that point. But the other way around, if the Dayanim have reasons to think that he's innocent, and one of the Talmidim realizes, hey, you know what, you're misunderstanding the halacha over here or whatever, then he doesn't get to speak up to say that. And in fact, if he tries to speak up in a case like that, we tell him to be quiet, as we're going to learn later on in the next parak. Actually, the Yad Ramah says that the Yad Ramah says that if he manages to get a word in edgewise before they tell him to be quiet, then yeah, they do have to take into consideration what he says. But they're going to try to get him to be quiet and not to say that point in the first place. Not everybody agrees to that, though. But in any case, basically, but if it's l'schus, then we're definitely going to listen to him. So that's another distinction. Next. When it comes to dinim mominus, the dayonim themselves can change their minds in between. If one of them has given a reason to say that he was guilty, then he can change his mind. And no one said, after all, I found a reason to say that he's exempt from paying, and vice versa. Dinin nefoshes hamalamed choiva hamalamed schus aval hamalamed schus en yochel lachzor lamed choiva. But when it comes to dinin nefoshes, once he said a reason to declare the guy innocent, then they can't. He can't go and say instead of choiva. Rashi points out the svara is because after all you have to have the hitzilu. You have to have that they make every effort to try and exonerate and save the person from being executed. So therefore, so it's a svara that once he said a reason, the schos would be a reason why he can't change his mind and say l'choiva. That said, Rashi points out based on the Gemara further on that's only b'shas maso matan. That's only when they're discussing back and forth what we should do in this case, whether we should declare him guilty or innocent. On the other hand, Rashi points out when it comes to the Gemar Din, the Gemara is going to explain later on, when it comes to giving the actual verdict, then it would actually be that he could change his mind, meaning during the Maso Mata, during the discussion back and forth, each one is turning it over and saying, here's reasons, here's possible reasons to declare him innocent, here's possible reasons to declare him guilty, so therefore once one of them has said a reason to declare him innocent, he can't change his mind. But when it comes to Gemar Din, means that he's already gone over all the possibilities, he realizes, you know what, after all, what I was thinking before is a mistake, then at that point he would be able to change his mind and to be able to say something. By the way, when we said before about people being able to speak up, and Rashi said it meant the Talmidim as well, that the Talmidim can speak up. The Ramban actually brings up a point of several points in this regard. Does that mean that Talmud who spoke up, would he actually count towards the number of Dayanim? So would we say, let's say we had 23 Dayanim over here sitting and deliberating over it, and one of them points out something L'schus, or in the case of Dinim Mominus, he can point out L'choiva as well. Does that mean that now we can count him as an extra Dayan, and his opinion will actually be counted to when we figure out the number of votes, or maybe not? He says that he brings up the Rambam, seems to say exactly that. In fact, also the Ramban points out later on in the next parak, we're going to talk about that even the defendant himself in Dinei Nefoshes is able to say something on his own behalf. And furthermore, the Ramban says that the Rambam would hold that then even the defendant himself counts as one of the Dayanim, although the Ramban says, come on, he can't count as one of the Dayanim. He can count, at least you can say that the Dayanim have to listen to what he says, but not necessarily to actually count him as one of them. Anyway, but here we're talking about the actual Dayanim themselves, where again, once he said something in favor of the defendant, when it comes to Dinei Nefoshes, when it comes to Dinei Mominus, he could change his mind and say something against him, whereas when it comes to Dinei Nefoshes, then not. Next. Dinei Mominus done in Bayoim. Dinei Mominus have to be judged by day, but the goyimin balayla, but we can finish up the din Torah by night. As long as we started by day, we can finish and say the verdict by night. Dinin nefashas goyimin by donin by yoim, but goyimin by yoim. Dinin nefashas, we have to judge them by day, and the verdict has to be given by day as well. Another difference: dinin nefashas dinin mominus goyimin by yoim ben laschus ben lachoiva. Dinin mominus, we can finish off on that day, on the same day, whether the schos or the choiva, so the same day that they heard the evidence from the edim and looked at the shtar and did whatever else they're supposed to, that same day they would also be able to, that same day they could also give the verdict once they discuss it among themselves. Dinin nefashas, but when it comes to dinin nefashas, goyimrim boi b'yem l'schos, if the verdict is going to be to exonerate him, then they can do it that same day. But if the verdict is going to be, if the majority are saying to convict him, then they can't do that day. They have to wait over for the next day, because when they sleep on it overnight, they may find some reason to exonerate him. We're going to talk about later on, in the next parak, we're going to talk about the details of that, how exactly they do that. In that case, they pair up, basically, and they discuss it among themselves, and they see if they can find any reason to exonerate him, after all. And if not, then the next day they come together and they give the verdict that he's guilty and is going to be chayiv misa. But they can't do it the same day, as we're going to learn later on in the Gemara from Pesukim. Next, so the Mishnah interjects, Lafichach, therefore, because of that point, that when it comes to L'choiva, they have to only give the verdict the next day, ain't done in Loiba Erev Shabbos or Loiba Erev Yom Tov. When it comes to Dinei Nefoshes, we can't judge them on Erev Shabbos or on Erev Yom Tov, because if it comes out, we don't know in advance, of course, what the verdict is going to be. It may come out that it's going to be that he's guilty. Now, we can't execute him on Shabbos, when the pasuk says, Lo Savaru Eish B'chomesh V'seichem B'yem HaShabbos, don't make a fire in any place where you live on Shabbos. It's not just the pasuk is not mentioning that just because fire is one of the 39 malachas. We learn from that it means when it comes to the Misas Beis Din of Sreifa, which we're going to learn later on, we're going to learn about later in the Masechta, you're not allowed to do that on Shabbos, and the same thing applies to any other Dinei Nefoshes. So we can't execute the person on Shabbos itself. We can't say once we declared him guilty on Friday, then we should wait until so like this. If we judge him on Friday, what's going to happen? We can't give the verdict l'choiva that same day Friday. We just said you can't do that. You can't give it the next day Shabbos, because then they would have to execute him on that day, and you can't execute him on Shabbos. You can't wait till Sunday. That would be called inui hadin. That would be delaying his din unnecessarily, because once you've given the verdict, you have to carry it out as soon as possible. So instead, what we have to do basically is we hold him, we keep him in a holding cell, we keep him in a temporary jail until Sunday, and then we start doing, and then we start judging the case. And if he's guilty, then he'll be executed on Monday. Okay. Continues the Mishnah. Another distinction, Dinei Mominus, when it comes to Dinei Mominus, and also Hatumas Vataras, also when it comes to cases of Tumah Vatara, if a case is brought to Beis Din to ask, when a person brings her to Beis Din to ask about something, is this Tomei or is that Tahor? So all those kinds of things, Maschilim and Agadol, those we begin asking from the greatest member of the Beis Din, from the Av Beis Din, whoever, who the senior member of the Beis Din, we ask him first. Out of respect for him. Dinei Nefoshes maschilim min hatzad. But when it comes to Dinei Nefoshes, we have to start from the side, meaning from the least, from the lesser dayanim, and then we work our way up. The reason is, Rashi says, because otherwise the greater dayan might say, for example, that he's guilty, and the lesser dayan may not want to contradict him. And then, after all, the pasuk says Lysana al Riv. Don't answer on Riv, which we darshan the word Riv. It's written in the pasuk without a yud, so we darshan it as though it said Rav. Lysana al Rav. Do not speak up against the Rav, against the greater one. So he may figure in that case, then he shouldn't speak up, and then that's going to come out. There's going to be ivus hadin. It's going to be a miscarriage of justice, because really this lesser dayan may have thought that it's better for him to, that he wants to exonerate the guy, and meanwhile he's going to be afraid to speak up to contradict the greater one. So Mefarshim discussed that point, that it's not so much that the Rambam actually in Pirush HaMishnah says it's not so much that he may not want to, he actually would be also to. But the point is, so Rashi is saying not so much that he's usur to, but that he may be afraid, he may be allowed to, la halacha, to contradict the greater one, but he's going to be afraid to. So therefore we start minatzad, and that way we avoid the whole problem. The lesser dayanim say their opinion, and then we work our way up to the greater one. The last difference, hakol ksher un lodin dinim mamonos, anybody is kosher to judge dinim mamonos, meaning Rashi says even a mamzer, the ena kosher and loaded dinin nefoshes, but not all Jews are kosher to judge dinin nefoshes. Ela koyanim levim yisraelim amasiim lekohuna. It has to be they can be koyanim who have yichus, or levim, or yisraelim who have enough yichus that their daughters can marry koyanim, meaning that there's no mamzerim or chalolim or whatever mixed in with their family. So only those kinds. The Gemara is going to learn later on in the Perek that we learn that the members of a Beis Din have to be in a way similar to Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu, after all, had good yichus. There's no mamzeros or anything in his family, of course. So therefore, we learn from that the members of a Beis Din have to be, when it comes to Dinei Nefoshes, have to be the same thing, as opposed to Dinei Mominus, we have more leeway there. Okay. So those are the 10. So altogether, you have 10 differences.
Shouldn't it be as stringent, because Dinei Mominus are notoriously more fickle, and the Mamona's case is more fickle. You really need someone who has total integrity. So how surprising is it that the requirements are not the same?
Well, we're not saying the dayanim on all kinds of cases, dinim mominus or dinim nefoshes, have to have integrity. They still have to be, you know, they still have to be all the characteristics that Yisrael said to Moshe when we're talking about appointing dayanim. Anshe emes, sonei botza, etc. We're not talking about that. Of course, those are the qualifications for a dayan in any case. What we're saying is we have to, when it comes to dinim nefoshes, we have to bend over backwards to do everything we can to exonerate the person. And most of these distinctions that we mentioned in the Mishnah have to do with that. And then this last distinction has to do with, we learn from we learn from Psukim about it.
Who says, though, that Yuchsim guarantee character? No one says that, and it shows many, many times it doesn't.
Wait, who says that what?
Who says that because you come from a family where you're...
No, we're not saying that. Obviously, not everybody who comes from a Miyuchas family is an Ish Emes and so forth. Obviously, we have to vet them. Later on in the Masechta, the Gemara is going to explain that was actually part of the job of the Sanhedrin Gdola, is to keep tabs on things all over Eretz Yisrael, and when they know of a person who has the qualifications to be a Dayan, then they would arrange to have him appointed as a local Dayan, and eventually he would rise up the ranks, and eventually he might even become a member of the Sanhedrin Gdola. No, we're not saying, of course, every person who has yichus has those qualities, but we're saying even if he has those qualities, if he doesn't have yichus, he can judge dinim mamonos, but he can't judge dinim nefashos based on exeris
hakosav. Why? That's the question. What, on the contrary, if he has yichus, he's going to be more biased towards someone like him.
No, not necessarily. Yeah, and if he is, then they know if he's biased, then he has no business serving on a base din in the first place.
Oh, so what's the reason?
The pasuk says that he have to be like Moshe Rabbeinu in that regard. So in other words, we're saying a person can be the most erlicha honest person, but if he doesn't have that yichus, then fine, let him judge dinim mamonos, but dinim nefashos he can't be judging. That's all.
There's nobody like Moshe Rabbeinu. The Torah says it itself.
Okay, obviously not. We mean at least that they're like him in certain ways. We'll wait till Daf Lamed Vav. We'll learn about it. Be'ez Hashem. Okay, so let's begin the Gemara. The Gemara says, now we started by saying in the Mishnah there is a similarity between Dinim Mominus and Dinim Nefashos, namely that by both of them we need Durishiv HaKira. We need to cross-examine the Edim very carefully. Well, the question is, Dinim Mominus Mimba In and Durishiv HaKira, is that in fact true that by Dinim Mominus we need to cross-examine the Edim so carefully? Now, the whole point of Durishiv HaKira, as we learned before, is to make it possible to do Hazama. The whole point of it is that this way, if other Edom come and say, "Imonu Hayisem, you were with us on the day that you claim this thing happened, you were with us someplace else," then we know the first group is Edom Zomim. But in fact, we're going to see when it comes to Dinin and Mominus, we don't necessarily have that concept. Or to Minu, I have a contradiction. A Braisa says, "Shtar Shazmane Koser Be'echad Benisin B'Shmita." If you have a shtar where it's dated the first of Nisan in a Shmita year. Now why Dafka a Shmita year? We're going to talk about soon in the Gemara why that is. So you have a shtar like that. Ubo Edim, and the Edim come and say V'omru and other. So now you have the Edim who are signed on the shtar, Reuven and Shimon. Now later on you have other Edim come and say Heyachatim Edim of shtar zeh. How could you have testified on the shtar on Aleph Nissan of the Shmita year? You were with us elsewhere at a place where you can't. Obviously, we're talking about far enough that you can't travel there in one day. Nevertheless, shtar kosher ve'ed of cherin. Nevertheless, we don't make the Edim zemin. We don't pass all the shtar. We say the shtar is fine and the Edim are fine. Chayshinan shem eicharuhu v'kasvuhu. Because the Edim may have post-dated it. Meaning, so Rashi explains Echaruhu v'chasivu. Now, first of all, why we're talking about Shmita, the Gemara is going to explain that, first of all, one second. But we know that Shmita is Meshamet. We know at the end of Shmita, if you haven't written a prusable, then the loan is going to be forfeit. However, Rashi explains there can be, first of all, where he has a mashkin, for example. The Gemara elsewhere explains that a debt with a mashkin is not canceled by Shmita. It can also be that he taka wrote a prusable. It can also be where the loan becomes due to pay before Rosh Hashanah of the year after Shmita. The loan is the loan disappears. It's meshamet at the very end of Shmita year. We have the minute we make a prusbel before Shmita and also after Shmita. That's because the Alter Rebbe talks about in Hilchas Halva that there are Rishonim who learn that maybe from the beginning of Shmita year, you're not allowed to demand the debt anymore. It's not actually literally canceled, but nevertheless, you can't demand it from the beginning of Shmita. But most poskim don't hold that way, and Rashi apparently doesn't either. So in other words, if you have, he took out a loan during Shmita year, as long as it's due before the end of Shmita, then he would be able to collect it. But when we're saying Chayshin and Shema Echaru v'Chasvu, Rashi explains maybe what it is they saw the Malva, they saw the Malva lending the Loiva previously. And they were supposed to write a shtar because whether there was a kinyan or whether he told them to write the shtar or whatever, and they didn't get around to writing it until Aleph Nissen. So now they wrote the place, and now they wrote. So what they did is they when they write that Aleph Nissen, this loan took place in such and such a place, what they're doing is they're saying the loan took place in this place. They're writing the loan took place in New York. But they're writing Aleph Nissen, meaning not that the loan took place on Aleph Nissen, but rather the loan took place a few days or a few months earlier, and we only got around to writing it on Aleph Nissen.
They write that whole thing?
So no, they don't write that Nusach. That's if they wrote the whole Nusach, there'd be nothing to talk about. We're talking about what we have is we have a shtar that says Reuven lent Shimon money on Rosh Chodesh Nissen in New York, and now when other Edom come and say, wait, on Aleph Nissen, on Rosh Chodesh Nissen of that year, you were with us in Eretz Yisrael in California or whatever it is, then they can say, no, you know what, the loan actually took place in Adar or in Shvat or whatever in New York. We didn't get around to writing it until Aleph Nissen. We wrote New York because that's where the loan actually took place. But nevertheless, we only got around to writing it then. Rashi actually points out that for that matter, even if they write the, even if they write the place that they're not writing the place, they're writing the place where the milva took place. Now Rashi points out the Gemara does actually elsewhere say that you're supposed to write the name of the place where the shtar was written, even if the actual thing took place elsewhere. Nevertheless, Rashi says that's only eitz tova. It's a good idea to do that in order to avoid in order to avoid potential hazama. But nevertheless, you could instead write the location where it actually took place, even though let's say they saw the loan take place in New York, but then they wrote the shtar in California. They're still right in New York. And when Adam come and say, wait, but you were in California with us then, they're going to say, yeah, but the halva took place a month or two earlier in New York. So the point is, so Drish of Hakira is not going to do any good with the Edim because we go based on what it says over there, but then we also go on the fact that they're saying that they can say that they wrote it earlier. Tosfos actually says you don't even need all of that. You can also say, Poshet, that they postdated the shtar for no particular reason. The shtar itself was actually written sometime before Aleph Nissen, but for whatever reason, they decided to write on the shtar the date Aleph Nissen. Same thing. In other words, the point is, either way, that's the Gemara says, V'isak radach b'in and drish v'chakira. If you're going to tell me that we need to investigate the Edim, heichi chashin and shem eicharu v'chasvu, how can we say maybe they postdated it? What do you mean? The Drish of a Chakira, the whole point of that is to show whether we can contradict them. So now, if we have, what are we talking about over here? We have two other Edim coming and saying, it clearly is not like you said in the Shtar. We're going to say, yeah, but maybe they post-dated it, or maybe they wrote it sometime after the Halva took place. Then what's the whole point of the Drish of a Chakira in the first place? So how can the Mishnah tell us that Echad Dinim Mominus, that when it comes to Dinim Mominus, you do Drish of a Chakira, if now we're saying they're contradicted by other Edim, and yet we're going to say Shema, but maybe they actually post-dated it, and therefore their Edus is kosher after all. Meaning, in other words, so a couple of explanations what all this means. The Binyan Shloimer explains Rashi as follows. If we're going to infer what they say, and we're going to say that even though it says Rosh Chodesh Nissen in New York, doesn't actually mean that the loan took place on Rosh Chodesh Nissen in New York. It took place sometime earlier. Then in that case, in effect, what we're saying is that we're giving them such a chazaka, we're giving them such a cheskas kashrus, and even after we have other edim that seemingly contradict them, we're going to say that they're okay. Well, in that case, what's the point of Dorish of Hakira in the first place? If they have a Cheskas Kashrus, we don't need to be Dorish of Hakira. Then the Tzemach Tzedek gives a different explanation. If you're going to tell me you need Dorish of Hakira Daraisa, and you're telling me therefore that Midaraisa, if we don't investigate them, then their Eidos is going to be no good. You have to have Dorish of Hakira, otherwise you don't have an Eidos. In that case, all the more so, if we do investigate them, and now it turns out they're contradicted, how can we end for them and reinstate their edus when we did Dorish Vachira, we found that now they're contradicted, and now we're going to end for and say, but after all, we're going to reinstate it. So all of that seems to show, therefore, that you don't need Dorish Vachira by Dinei Mominus, and yet the Mishnah is saying that you do. So the Gemara answers back, Velitai Mech. Well,
according to the Gemara, they could ask him, well, when did this happen? So we wrote down with it. So, see, yeah.
Yeah, but that's the thing. When we, so, if to begin with, if they explain themselves, well, let's say they don't, let's say they say, yeah, it says Aleph Nissen. Besides, you have a concept anyway, the Gemara mentions in various places. Edim achsumim al ashtar, once Edim are signed on ashtar, nasik mish nechkere dusin bebeistin. It's considered as though their edus has already been investigated by Beistin. Meaning, when we have a shtar that says, Aleph Nissen in New York, we take it as given. We take it as a given that yes, it's as if we were already chukav a derdish and find it was Aleph Nissen in New York. Now, when other Edim are coming and saying, "Wait, but Aleph Nissen, you were with us in California," then We're going to have to infer, yes, but maybe it was a shtar mo'ucha. We don't even necessarily have the original edim there to say. We're going to have to infer them, but how can we do that? Then what was the point of the drush of a hakira in the first place?
So you have to bring in the other edim, which are not necessarily available.
So the Gemara answers back, v'li taimeich, well, according to your svara, why are you even asking on, from the braisa, tikshir loch masnissin? Better, instead of asking from a braisa, ask from a mishnah. After all, a mishnah has more authority than a braisa. And a mishnah says in Masech Shvi'is, actually in connection with Prusbol and all that, it says, shtore chayv ha-mukdomin, predated shtore chayv, psulim, are possible. We learned about this in Baba Basra, because when it's predated, then it means you're making the shibud start from earlier than it actually was.
Yes.
He borrowed the money in Nissan. You're writing the shtar that it was an Adar, means you're saying that any property that he sold from Adar and that he owned in Adar and sold after that is under a shibud, and that's false because it's only from Nissan and on that the shibud would be in effect. We learned about it there, over there in Baba Basra. Rashi and Tosfos argue, does it mean the shtar is completely possible? Does it just mean you can only collect with it in Bnei Chorin? Whatever. Anyway, the point is, Vamu Chorin. But post-dated shtaris hakosher. So the isak darich, but in drish of a hakira. If you're telling me that you need drish of a hakira, that you need to cross-examine the edim, mochorin amay kshayrim, then why would shtari chayv that are post-dated? Why would they be kosher? After all, though, again, the whole point of the drish of a hakira is to contradict them, and here you're not going to be able to do that because they were going to say that it was mochor. So in other words, so Rashi says that the point is, in other words, that. So we're saying, why is it kosher? Because we're saying, fine, he's willing to be moichel the shibud until a later date. But still, this demonstrates you're in derish of a hakira. Again, how are we otherwise for entering the shtar? Say that the shtar is completely forged. They never saw this milva in the first place. There are other edim who say that they saw it. Fine, it's going to be a milva al peh. But it's not going to be a milva b'shtar if the shtar itself was obviously not written on the date that purports to have been on. So therefore, we see you don't need derish of a hakira. So instead of asking from a braisa that says that the shtar is mana kosa be'echad b'nissin, ask from the Mishnah in Shvi'is that it seems to contradict our Mishnah in Sanhedrin. The answer is holei kasha. That's not such a question. The reason why we didn't bring the question from the Mishnah in Shvi'is is da difa minor kaminin, because we want to bring from the braisa because it's a stronger question. Da filu echad b'nissin, because the Mishnah in Shvi'is just mentioned generically a post-dated shtar. Fine, you could say it's post-dated. That doesn't mean necessarily that there's something so wrong with it. But the Braisa, when it mentions specifically Aleph Nissen in a Shmita year, seems something unusual. There's a reason to think, much more so, that there's something fishy with the star. Da'afilu echad b'nissen b'shmita. You're talking the first of Nissen in Shmita, meaning it's less than 6 months until the debt is going to be canceled unless there's a prusbol or a mashkin or whatever. D'loy shchichi inshi d'moizvi. It's not as common for people to lend money as you get towards the end of Shmita. Now it's true the Torah warns you don't think like that. Don't think kova shnasa shreva. It's almost Shmita. The debt is going to be canceled. I don't want to lend. But nevertheless, the practice, practically speaking, people are going to be a little unwilling to lend then, unless there's a mashkin or unless they make some kind of other arrangement that it won't be canceled. So you would think the lekla meimah shema echaru v'chasvu. So think about it. How likely is it that they post-dated the shtar and wrote it? Delemara l'shtori. A person doesn't want to ruin his shtar. Meaning, in other words, he lent the money, let's say, before Shmita even, or earlier during the Shmita year. It's going to be dated later during Shmita is less likely. People are going to think it's less likely that he lent money so close to the end. So there's much more reason for people to think maybe this whole shtar is forged. So in a regular time, fine. A person might not mind so much if the loan took place in Shvat, and they wrote it in Nissan. Fine, so it means that I'm delaying my shibud by 2 months. Fine, big deal. But here, where you have it, it's not only I'm delaying my shibud; it's going to make people more likely to think that there's something wrong with the shtar. Who would lend money when it comes Nissan of a Shmita year, where it's so close to the time when the loan is going to be canceled altogether?
Canceled
at the end of it. It's canceled at the end as Rosh Hashanah is coming in. Comes Shkia coming into Rosh Hashanah. Then it's canceled. Because after all, afilu hochi, nevertheless, given to Shvius, soifa mishametas. Since Shmita, it's only the end of it is mishamet machshirinam. And then we do say it's kosher. We're saying it's true, it will eventually get canceled. Nevertheless, the fact is, Shmita is Meshamet only at the end. So therefore, we have reason to say that it was post-dated, and therefore that it can be kosher. So therefore, but there is a bigger chiddush from that braisa, therefore that even in a case like that, we're going to say it's kosher. We're not going to say there seems to be something wrong with it. Who would lend money in Nissan? We're saying that the people might well do that. Well then, so then now we have a question though. The fact is that that requires us to fa'enfer what the Edom are saying, and that means then what was the point of the drush of a chakira in the first place? Whereas our Mishnah is saying echad dinim mamonis with drush of a chakira. So that's why. So in other words, the Gemara is saying, yes, we could have asked the question from the Mishnah and Shvius, but that wouldn't be a stronger question. The stronger question is from the Braisa that even a Shtar, where we have reason to think based on the date of it, that there might be something wrong with it. Nevertheless, we can still forenfer that, yes, it was written on that unusual, that yes, it bears that unusual date, but it doesn't mean it was forged. It just means it was post-dated by a month or two. Well, how does that fit with our Mishnah that you need Dudish of a Chakira? So the Gemara says Mikol Makom Kasha. So then the bottom line is that either way, whether we ask from the Mishnah and Shvius, or whether we ask for or whether we ask from our Mishnah Kasha, or whether we ask from the Braisa Kasha, either way you have a Kasha on our Mishnah. So the Gemara gives Simon Charpash. This is a Simon for the names of four Amiroyim who are going to give answers to this Stira: Rav Chanina, Rava, Rav Papa, and Rav Ashi. Charpash, yeah. Okay. So number one, Amar Rav Chanina, Dvar Torah, Echad Dinim Mamonis, Ve'echad Dinim Nefashas, B'Dirush Rav HaKira. As a matter of fact, Minat Torah, both Dinim Mamonis and Dinim Nefashas would require Dirush Rav HaKira. Shanema, because we said at the beginning, Mishpat Echad, as the Mishnah said, Mishpat Echad Yolachem. There should be one rule for you for Dinim Mamonis and Dinim Nefashas. Uma Tam Omru Dinim Mamonis Loiber in Dirush Rav HaKira. So how do we come up then with the Din in Masech Teshvius and with the Din in the Braisa that implies that you don't need Dirush Rav HaKira, and therefore that you can accept the Shtar and assume that it's post-dated, as the famous thing, Kadesh Latino Delos, Bifnei Loivin, so you don't lock the door in front of borrowers. So in other words, if a Malva knew that when the Edom come to Beis Din, they're going to be cross-examined with the full battery of Dirush Rav HaKira, he's going to say, you know what, there's a good chance the Edom may make a mistake. They may accidentally contradict each other on the date or the time or whatever. And then the whole thing is going to be thrown out and I'm not going to be easily able to collect my debt. So I don't want to bother in the first place. So like this, by saying you don't have to do the Dirush Rav HaKira, then it makes people more likely to want to lend money. So therefore, so in short, our Mishnah is talking about the Din D'oraisa, and the Mishnah in Shvius and the Braisa are talking about after the Takanas HaChamim.
So the
Chachamim
said, or the ones that you don't have to
make. So the Chachamim are saying that as a Takana, you don't need Dirush Rav HaKira, and therefore post-dated Shtoris are fine. Well, the Gemara asks Elamayata by that logic, if we're trying to make it easier for the Malva to collect his debt. Maybe we should say that if the Dayanim make a mistake in the Halacha, they shouldn't have to reimburse the one who they made lost. Now you have to think, maybe if you had allowed them to do Dirush Rav HaKira, they would have found there's something wrong. How can we say now, we told you not to do Dirush Rav HaKira? Well, now, tough luck, you made a mistake, now it's on you. Why can't the Dayanim answer back, you know what? And if we had been able to do Dirush Rav HaKira, then we wouldn't have made a mistake in the first place. And the answer is, fine, the answer is exactly that. Then you're going to make it even less likely for people to lend money. People are going to be afraid that the Dayanim might make a mistake and mistakenly say that the Loiva doesn't have to pay. And the Malva is going to say, well, why should I bother lending money in the first place? So Adarabba, we want to give the Malva more of a smichus das, more of a guarantee that he's going to be able to, that he's going to be, that one way or the other, either he'll win the case and he'll get his money back, or that if he loses it, but it turns out the Dayanim made a mistake, then also he'll be able to get reimbursed. So now he's much more likely to be willing to lend money in the first place, even with the knowledge that it'll go to Beis Din. Okay, so that's one answer. So it's D'oraisa versus D'rabbanan. Second answer, Rava Omer, Masnisin Dehocha B'dinei Knossos. Our Mishnah is talking about Dinei Knossos. So we're going to say, in other words, that both, we're going to say that Midrabanan, you don't need Dirush Rav HaKira when it comes to Dinei Mamonos. However, our Mishnah is talking about Dinei Knossos. Within Dinei Mamonos themselves, we're going to say the Chachamim did not take away the need for Dirush Rav HaKira when it comes to Knossos. Because by Knossos, there's no problem of Ne'ilas Delas. The whole point of Ne'ilas Delas is you want to make it attractive for people to lend money, knowing that they have a good chance of getting it back. On the other hand, when it comes to knossos, you don't need that. Those knossos are, somebody didn't lend out money. You're talking about somebody has to pay kafel, somebody has to pay 30 sloyim for his shirt having killed an eved or whatever. There's nothing where a person to begin with laid out money for a loan. We're now worried about ne'ilas delas. Therefore, the chachamim had no reason to change the din d'oraisa, says Rava, when it comes to knossos, that you should need Dirush Rav HaKira. when it comes to the Idach, the other mission, and the Braisa are talking about Bahu Doris Vahalvois. We're talking about when we're talking about that the Edom are testifying that they saw the loan or the Hoidah, as we learned about in detail in the previous parak, then we're gonna say Shalotino Delos Bifne Loven, we're gonna relax the need for Hakira, for judicial Hakira. Okay. That's a second answer. Rapapa gives a third answer. We could even say that both our Mishnah and the other Mishnah in Shvius and the Braisa are all talking about Hodoris Valvois. Neither one of them has to necessarily be talking about a Knas. We can be talking about generically any Dinim Mominus. But can be din Meruma. It depends whether we're talking about a Din. A din Torah where Beistin has reason to think that the plaintiff is a Ramai, or they realize that he's a cheater, or that there's something in what he's saying that seems to be dishonest. So in other words, the point would be when they don't have reason to suspect that, then we don't need Dirish of a Hakira. But when they have reason to suspect that, then they need to do Dirish of a Hakira. Now Tosfos explains actually that. If they know for a fact the din is completely meruma, they know that Reuven is bringing Shimon to Beis Din on a completely made-up charge, then they don't even judge it in the first place. Because then, what do you mean? Reuven, what are you hacking a chinik by us? We know perfectly well you're saying that Shimon owes you this money, and we know perfectly well it's not so. Rather, Tosfos says, here we're talking about, and the Gemara actually in Shavuos learns that from Midvar Sheker Tircha. So what we mean is, yes, we don't, as far as we know, it might be that Shimon owes you money, Reuven, but we can recognize that there's something fishy with your arguments or with your edim or whatever. So then we need Dirish V'Chakira, we need to examine and investigate very closely to see what's going on over here. In fact, the Rosh points out in this connection that first of all there can be a difference who is based in suspecting of being the Ramai. If it's the Teveya, then you have the Gemara and Shavuos. Don't bother with the Din Torah in the first place because we can recognize the guy is stam lying. As opposed to what happens, Reuven is taking Shimon to Beis Din, and Reuven, we have reason to believe that Shimon Taka owes him. But we're saying Shimon is the one who may be giving false evidence or false aid or whatever. Well, then we can't just say, well, let's throw out the Din Torah, and then Shimon is going to gain from the fact that he's cheating. Then we have to, as we're saying over here, we need to examine the whole matter very closely and figure out and demonstrate that Shimon or his Edom are liars and take it from there. So then the Ran brings another point as well from Rabbeinu David that it means, in other words, that it doesn't even in this case, it doesn't mean that we need the full battery of Dirish of Hakira. It just means, in other words, that if he has reason to think that there's Ramos over here, then he has to investigate that particular detail and figure it out. You have many, many stories over the centuries of Rabbonim who did that, where they realize that somebody is saying something that doesn't seem to be true, and they figure out how to get him to expose himself as a liar. There's many stories along those lines. So in any case, that's what we mean, in other words. So again, that's your Papa's answer. It depends whether it's a din meruma or not. So kidu Resh Lakish, as in fact we see that Resh Lakish makes it a distinction. To Resh Lakish Rami, Resh Lakish pointed out a seeming contradiction between psukim. Ksid betzedek tishpat amisecha. One pasuk says you should judge your fellow yid with righteousness. Ochtiv, and a different pasuk says tzedek tzedek tirdoif. Tzedek, righteousness. You should pursue. So why does the one pasuk say tzedek only once, and the other one says tzedek tzedek? So what's the difference? So he explains the Hoket said can be din meruma, can be din shena meruma. So exactly that distinction. If you know that both of them are, if the Dayan perceives that both of them are arguing truthfully, then you just need plain old tzedek. But if you have reason to think that one of them is hiding some facts or doing like that, then you need tzedek tzedek. Then you really need to delve into it and figure out what's actually going on over here. So that's the tzedek tzedek. Yeah. There was a famous vote on it, by the way, also that says that tzedek tzedek means you, even when you're pursuing tzedek, you have to do it in a tzedek way. Meaning in English, you have the expression sometimes the ends justify the means. The ends justify the means, meaning you say, I'm doing this for a good purpose, so it doesn't matter whether I'm using unethical ways to get there as long as I'm doing it for a good purpose. So no, the Torah is telling you tzedek tzedek, the tzedek itself has to be accomplished with tzedek, not with dishonest methods. Anyway, so here we're saying, though, that it means a different thing. It means that if you have reason to think that there's a din meruma over here, then put in the extra tzedek. Rav Ashi gives a fourth answer. Masnissin Kedishanyan. As far as the Mishnayos and Braisis, those we're going to reconcile using one of the previous explanations. Kroy, but as far as the Psukim that Rish Lakish brought, Tzedek Tishma Damisecha versus Tzedek Tzedek Tirdif, Rav Ashi says you don't need to reconcile them the way Rav Ashi said, the way Rav Shlokesh had said, that it depends whether it's a din meruba or not. Rather, echad the din ve'echad the pshara. Rather, the two psukim, one is talking about judging the actual din Torah, the other is talking about making a pshara. Meanwhile, as we learned in the first parak about the topic, where sometimes Beis Din will make a pshara, sometimes Beis Din will make a broker a compromise between the two sides. So therefore, we're saying like this, when it's an actual din Torah, then it just means tzedek, meaning in other words that you have to decide according to the way it is al pi halacha. But when it comes to a pshara, then you have to be more careful. Tzedek tzedek, meaning Rav Ashi is saying that it means make sure that what you're deciding is right, and also make sure that your pshara is correct as well, meaning that it's not biased in one of them more in favor of one of them more than the other. So you need the extra tzedek when it comes to a pshara where you're brokering a compromise. Make sure it's not accidentally favoring one of them more than the other. Kidatani, as in fact we learn in a braisa, tzedek tzedek tirdif echad the din ve'echad the pshara. In the words tzedek tzedek itself, it means sometimes you have a din Torah versus sometimes you have a pshara. Now, not just a pshara in Beis Din, but we're going to discuss a pshara between two different people who have conflicting claims on the road, for example, and we have to make a pshara between them. We have to make sure that the pshara is as fair as possible. Kate said, what do we mean? Suppose you have two boats passing one that are going to pass a place in the river. And they both meet up with one another, coming in opposite directions. And if they both try to cross through, then they're going to both end up sinking because they're going to bang into each other and they're both going to end up getting damaged and sink. But if they go one after the other, then both of them will be able to go safely. The question is, which one gets to go first then? V'chein shnei gmalim, the same way you have two camel drivers. Show you olim amilus beis choron. They're both going up the ascent of beis choron. Beis choron is a town in Eretz Yisrael. There are actually two towns called beis choron elyon and beis choron tachton. Nowadays they're Arab villages, although there is near beis choron elyon, there's a Jewish community over there. Anyway, there's a place over there where there's a very narrow, steep ascent. So you go up there and you're walking basically along the side of a cliff. So in those days that was a major route in that part of Eretz Yisrael. So now suppose you have two camel drivers coming from opposite directions meet up with one another over there. Im olu shnei, and if both of them are going to try to go up and pass by each other, shnei and noflin, they're going to both end up falling off because it's such a narrow place. Shnei and olin, but if they go one after the other, then they're both going to go safely. So again, the question is which one has to give way to the other one. So how do we do it? Tu'una v'she'ena tu'una. Suppose that one of them is carrying a load and the other one is not. Tidocha she'ena tu'una m'pnei tu'una. The one that's not carrying the load has to give way. We're going to say, in other words, the one who's carrying the load, the animal is struggling with the load, or even if not, whatever you want, he wants to get his load to where he's going to sell it as soon as possible. So therefore he gets the right of way and the other one has to wait for him.
Why don't you
have
him first?
No, but wait. If one of them is close and the other one is far, meaning Rashi says close and far means to its city. So meaning, in other words, kroiva would be, in other words, one is closer to the city that it came from. And she'ena kroiva means the other one is further away from the city that it came from. Let's say, in other words, neither one of them are carrying a burden, or both of them are. Then instead of looking at the burden, instead we look at kroiva v'she'ena kroiva. So then tidocha kroiva m'pnei she'ena kroiva. The one that's closer has to give way to the one that's not closer, meaning, in other words, because he's gone a longer distance. There are other mafoshim who understand kroiva and ena kroiva differently. It can mean kroiva closer to the destination. It can mean kroiva as in closer to, as in sort of like what you say in the one that came first. A number of different ways that the mafoshim have of explaining that particular phrase. Anyway, shtei and kroiva, what if both of them are equally far or equally near? And let's say both of them are carrying burdens, or both of them not. So then you have to make a pshara between them. And the one has to compensate the other one for the time that he has to wait. So one of them will get to go up first, and the other one is going to have to pay a little extra for that privilege of getting the right of way. So this is an example of tzedek, tzedek tirdef. We're making a compromise as fairly as possible, and we also, when necessary, then there's compensation involved as well. There is, by the way, in connection with this story in the Gemara, with this case in the Gemara, there's a very famous story they tell in this connection. In the early 1950s, the Israeli government, the state of Israel, had just been formed. And they were discussing the whole matter of drafting women for the army. Here it's now 70-odd years later, and they're still having the same argument. In any case, the G'dayli Yisrael of that time were very, very opposed to it. Some of them went so far as to say it's Yehorig Val Yaver. Our Rebbe was new in the position at the time. He also got involved with it, but not as publicly. You can find in Igros Kodesh, you can find many letters that the Rebbe wrote at that time to Israeli politicians and other people telling them to work on it, but kind of behind the scenes. But there were other G'dayli Yisrael who came out very publicly against it, most famously the Chazon Ish. So then the story goes that the Ben Gurion, the prime minister of Israel, decided he has to go visit the Chazon Ish and talk to him about it. I've heard one version of the story that he actually dressed up like a yeshiva person with a hat and jacket, whatever the case. Anyway, he went to visit the Chazon Ish. He tells him, you know, listen, I mean, we're short of manpower, v'chola v'chola. The Chazon Ish tells him, listen, David, you learned in Yid, you learned in Cheder back in the day, so you learned Gemara. So I'm going to tell you something in Gemara Loshen. He tells him this Gemara over here that we have over here. And he says, listen, so now let's consider. We from Jews are like in the story over here, like the camel that's carrying the heavy burden. We have a burden, we have a load that we're carrying of thousands of years of Torah and mitzvahs. You guys are like the empty camel because you're new. Your state is what, 3 or 4 years old? We see from this Gemara, you have to give way to us. We get the right of way first, and you have to give way to us. The story continues. I've heard a version of the story where Ben Gurion says, what do you mean we're an empty camel? The fact is we just established a state, and the Chazon Ish tells him that's not, you know, compared to what we've accomplished over the thousands of years, doesn't really count for much. In any case, eventually they made a compromise that basically frum girls are exempted from it. It wasn't very satisfactory. The Rebbe, in particular, you can find in letters of his, was not satisfied with that compromise at all. What do you mean, frum or not frum? They're all Jewish girls. But that's how they ended up working it out, and then over the years there's been a lot of friction of it over the years. It's come up many times. Sometimes there have been cases where there were frum girls who the draft boards claimed are not frum and they have to serve in the actual army. There's been all kinds of, over the years, there's been many, many, many problems with that issue. But anyway, whatever. Anyway, so the point is that, yeah, so there's this story, this case over here in the Gemara came up in that connection. Okay. Going on, the Gemara says, Tana Rabbanan, as I'm saying, our Rebbe was involved in it, but more behind the scenes.
Ben Gurion
no? Never met the Rebbe, as far as I know. No. Okay. Tana Rabbanan, we learn in a Braisa. No, you're thinking of Shazar. Shazar, later on, the president of Israel, was he came from a Lubavitcher family, and he was very close to the Rebbe over the years, and he visited several times. Yeah. Okay. Tana Rabbanan, tzedek tirdef. The pasuk says, righteousness, you should pursue. Here's another din that we learn from that. Holachacha based in Yofa. You should always go to the best based in available for your dine Torah. For example, Acha Rabbi Yezer Lud. For example, if you're in the area of Lud, go to Rabbi Yezer's based in. Rabbi Yezer was the Rosh Hashiva in Lud. That's the best based in that area. If you're in the area of the town called Brur Chayil, go to Rabbi Yechonon Zakkai. Now, interestingly, we know Rabbi Yechonon Zakkai was in Yerushalayim until the Churban, and then after that he got himself smuggled out of Yerushalayim. We find him later on in Yavne. So there are some Mephoshim who say that maybe Brur Chayil is another name for Yavne, or at least for a particular neighborhood in Yavne or whatever. But there's another interesting idea. Doris Hirishonim explains, based on this Gemara, that, and based on another, based on some Midrashim as well, that actually what it was is like this. Rabbi Yechonon Zakkai got himself smuggled out of Yerushalayim, and he went to Aspas Yonos, as we know the story in Gittin, and he told him, Ten li Yavne v'chachamel. So he was able
to... were friends from before, right? He's the one who played... He's good, come king.
No, they were friends from before. Aspas Yonos is a big anti-Semite, but yeah, he met him. He told him, you're going to be the emperor, and shortly after that, they tell him, and the whole story. So therefore, Aspas Yonos gives him three, they grants him three wishes, and the first one is tending the Yavne v'chachamel. So Rabbi Yechonon Zakkai and the Chachamim go to Yavne, and they reestablish the Sanhedrin, they reestablish the Beis Din over there. And he set up Rabbi Gamliel as Nasi. Now, then Doris HaRishonim explained, listen, at this point, Rabbi Gamliel was much younger than Rabbi Yechim ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yechim ben Zakkai by this time was almost 120 years old. He's one of the few Chachamim that we know that lived to be 120. He was very much more respected. So he figured if he stays in Yavne, he's going to overshadow Rabbi Gamliel. Who's going to pay attention to the Nasi Rabbi Gamliel, who was maybe 30 or 40 or 50 years old, in comparison with the great Rabbi Yechim ben Zakkai, the Talmud of Hillel and Shammai. So he left Yavne, moved to the town of Baruch Hayil, and set up a small yeshiva and a beis din over there. This way he's not interfering with Rabbi Gamliel's nasius. So that would be what the Gemara means over here, that if you're in the area of Baruch Hayil, go to his yeshiva. He stayed there as long as necessary to train him, but then he left in order not to overshadow him. So the Gemara interjects. Speaking of Baruch Hayil, it's not really mentioned very often. So the Gemara interjects a minute. Tana, we learn in a Braisa, Kil Rechayim Bavuni. If you hear the sound of millstones in the town of Bruni, then you should know it means Shavua Ben, Shavua Ben. It's like an announcement that there's going to be a bris going on. Shavua Ben literally means the week of the sun, because a bris takes place a week after the baby is born. Rashi explains that there were times when there was gzera by the Romans not to do bris mila. So they couldn't openly announce that there's a bris mila. Instead, they would have the millstones grinding to grind up spices and herbs that they're going to need in order to treat the milah. So then when you heard those millstones grinding, then it was a simon that there's going to be a bris going on in town.
You grind it every day for bread, for different...
No, so that evidently we have a particular kind of mill that they would use for grinding spices and things like that. Or maybe it sounds different when you're grinding different kinds of things. I don't know. Tosfos brings from the Yerushalmi that says something similar as well. On the other hand, Tosfos brings a pasuk that actually mentions Kol Rechayim Ve'or Ner. Hashem says that there's going to be a time when simchas are going to be removed from the Jewish people, the time of the Churban, and it includes Kol Rechayim, the sound of millstones, Ve'or Ner, and the light of a candle, which is the next simon the Gemara is going to mention. And Yumi is written long before the Gzeres HaMalchus. So Tosfos explains originally they would do these things as a sign of simcha. So when there was a bris going on, they would make a loud public thing with grinding spices in honor of the bris. Now, later on, when there was Gzeres HaMalchus, they repurposed that same method to use as a simon to tell the people who need to know that there's a bris without the Romans knowing about it. Then the Braisa continues, Ur HaNer B'Bror Chayil, when you see a light of a lamp in Bror Chayil, Mishtasham, then it's a simon that there's a party, meaning a wedding going on over there. Same idea, in other words, that... this way, if you see a lot of candles, a lot of lamps lit in one place, then it means that there's a mishta going on over there. Again, this way to evade the Romans.
We're supposed to have the one of our weddings?
No, so there were times when the Romans would interfere. There were times when the Gemara mentions in some places they had the law to boil the Hegman Tchila, the caliphers has to go to the local Goyish governor or whatever. Yeah, so the Tosfos points out, actually, it seems that also the Ur HaNer was also meant also for the Simcha of a Bris Milah. And therefore, Tosfos says that's why we have the minhag to light a lot of candles, to have a lot of light when it comes to a Bris Milah as part of the Simcha. So the Gemara continues, Tana Rabbanan, Tzedek, Tzedek Tirdif, again, Holach Acha Chachamim Liyeshiva. Besides that we said, Holach Acha based in Yofa, go to the best based in available, it also means follow the Chachamim to the Yeshiva, which is again, the Yeshiva doubles as the based in. So therefore you're going to go there for the based in Kavua, to have your Dine Torah judge there. For example, Acha Rabbi Eliezer Lud, as we said, Rabbi Eliezer was the Rav in Lud. Acha Rabbi Yechon Ben Zakkai LeBrochayil. Acha Rabbi Yeshua LePekiyin. If you're in the area of Pekiyin, which is a town in the north of Eretz Yisrael, go to Rabbi Yeshua's yeshiva and Beis Avad. Acha Rabbi Gamliel LeYavne. Acha Rabbi Akiva LeBnei Brak. He was the Rav over there. Achar Rab Masya L'Roimi. If you're in the area of Roimi, then go to Rab Masya. Some say that Roimi means the actual city of Rome. Some say that it's actually a name of a town in Eretz Yisrael.
Big difference.
There are sichas where the Rebbe seems to understand it the first way, because there are sichas where the Rebbe talks about Ramasya ben Chorosh in Roimi, and the Rebbe seems to understand that it means the actual city of Rome, and it shows what he was accomplishing over there in terms of transforming the world for the good of Elikos, even the Talmudica city of Rome. But yeah, anyway. Achar Rab Chananya ben Tradian l'Sichni, if you're in the area of Sichni, go to Rab Chananya ben Tradian's Beis Medrash. Achar Rab Yosi l'Tzipori, because he was the Rav there. Achar Rab Yehuda ben Meseirul l'Tzivin. Achar Rab Yeshua l'Goyla, follow Rab Yeshua for the Goyla. Goyla means Bavel, but more specifically, Goyla means Pumbedisa. Now, we said before Rabbi Yeshua is in Pekin. So the Aruch HaNer says maybe one of them is Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, regular Rabbi Yeshua, and the other one is Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha. On the other hand, Agoris HaGura says over here, based on other Gemaras, it's supposed to be not Rabbi Yeshua, but rather Chananya ben Achi Rabbi Yeshua. Chananya, the nephew of Rabbi Yeshua, who we find he had a great Beis Din, he had a big Beis Din in Bavel, in the city of Nahavda or Pumbedisa in Bavel. And the last one, and the last two, Acha Rebbe leBeis Shorim. If you're in the area of Beis Shorim, go to Rebbe. And if you're in the area of the Lushkas HaGozes, then you go to the Chachamim. Now you'd have to ask, what's the chiddush of that last one? Of course, the Lushkas HaGozes is the highest based in. So Rabbi Yaakov Emden points out what it means is even, let's say, the Chachamim, for example, 40 years before the Churban, the Chachamim moved elsewhere. Nevertheless, when possible, go to them in Lushkas HaGozes anyway. They don't sit there most of the time, but when you do, Malamad Shamokim, or no, actually, Rabbi Yaakov Emden says, sorry, he says, even if it so happens that there were actually greater Chachamim elsewhere, even if it happens at a particular time, let's say for whatever reason, the Chachamim and Lushkas HaGozes are not the actual greatest Chachamim of the generation. Nevertheless, Hamokim Gurdim, the place itself, that they're in the Beis Hamikdash, it outweighs that. And therefore, you should go to them, even though there are other greater rabbanim elsewhere. There's an interesting pirush called Amtachas Bin Yamin, where he asks about that, and he asks also Bichlal. I mean, what is the Braisa here just to teach us historical facts? Why is it important for us to know that Rabbi Eliezer is in Lourdes and Rabbi Yechim and Zaka is in Baruch Hayil, etc.? So he says what it means is the Braisa wants to tell us when it says achar, after, means even after they've passed away. Even, let's say, after Rabbi Eliezer passed away, but the members of his Beis Din in Lud are still functioning there in the Beis Din. As long as they are alive and they're members of the Beis Din who sat with him when he was alive, go to them as well. They still have. There's a pasuk in Kehelas that has the expression, Mokum sheyipol ha'etz shom yehu. That wherever a tree falls, there it is. Meaning, if you have a place where there was a great Talmid Chacham, even after he passed away, his influence is still felt there for a long time. So if you're in Lud, even though Rabbi Eliezer has already passed away, but nevertheless his Beis Din is still sitting there, go there, because you should know there's still a powerful influence of him on them, and therefore you should go there. And he goes and explains all the other ones in the same vein.
That's a good reason we have to go to 770.
That's a good reason to go to 770, I guess you could say, yeah. Okay. Next, Dine Mominus Poischin Chola. We said when it comes to Dine Mominus, we start by talking. We said by Dine Mominus, we can start either L'schus or L'choiva. We can make a statement that implies to begin with that we're going to see whether Pliny is liable to pay, or we can start with a statement that says we're going to see whether Pliny does not have to pay. On the other hand, with Dine Nefashis, we said that we always have to start L'schus. We always have to start with a statement that implies that we're going to start with the assumption that you're innocent. However, then we're going to go and discuss it. So the Gemara says, "Hechi Aminin." What expression do we use? Amar of Yehuda, "Hechi Aminin Lahu." We start by telling the Edim, "Mi Yema Kidkam Ritu." Who says that it's like? Who says that what you're saying is correct? Maybe you're colluding, or something like that. So that would be a way of starting by to exonerate the guy. We start by saying to the Edim, "How do we know that what you're telling is true?" Ula says, "How can you say such a thing? Then it's going to cause the Edim to be afraid to speak up." So Rashi explains the problem is they're going to retract b'toich kedei dibur, where they would still be able to. Tosfos says, come on, I mean, the time it takes to say, for one thing, the time it takes to say, mi yema kedakam ritu, is longer than toich kedei dibur. So Tosfos says, Tosfos gives a couple of answers. One of them is that as long as Beis Din hasn't investigated their eders, they could change their mind. When we say kivin shehigid shuvani choyzer magid, that would be once Beis Din has examined their eders and come to a conclusion, then later on they can't say, you know what, we were lying or anything like that. We're going to have something about that later on. We're going to have a famous story on Daf Mem Dalet about that. But if they could admit, but it won't change anything. If after the Gemar Din or after Beis Din has heard their Eders and investigated it, and then they say, you know what, we were lying, or they say something else, and they say, Kivin Shehigid, Shuv Eni Chozer Magid. But Tosfos says, as long as we haven't reached that point yet, then yes, they could. So here, in other words, hypothetically, if the Edim were to say, well, we were on the corner of Montgomery and Kingston on such and such a date, and we saw Reuven kill Shimon and whatever, then if Beis Din is going to tell them, who says what you're saying is true? They might say, you know what, it's true, we're lying, he didn't do it. But then how could we do that? So then it's causing them to, then the fact is maybe they were telling the truth and they were just being scared off by Beis Din. So the Gemara says, so what's the problem? V'lachsamu, so let them be scared off. Milay Tanya, after all, don't we learn in a Braisa? Reb Shimon Elazar, Oma Masiyin Se'edim L'mokim L'mokim. During the whole case, we have the Edim move around from one place to another, from one room to another. Meaning, in other words, like we might tell them, for example, that We're going to tell them that before or during the Kabbalah Seder, we're going to tell them, you know what, we don't want to hear you in this room. Let's go to another room and we'll hear you over there. And then, you know what, we changed our mind. We're going to go back to the original room. And with all the walking back and forth, this way they may get confused, and they'll change their mind. And they won't testify falsely after all. So what's wrong with telling them, oh, you're really telling the truth and scaring them off? The Gemara says, Midomi, how do you compare that? In that case, you're not telling them to undo what they said. You're distracting them from one place to another, and they themselves may say, you know what, we forgot. They may think to themselves, you know what, now I can't remember all the details that I was going to say, and therefore it's going to come out, their edus is going to come out garbled, and we're going to say, well, then we don't really have an edus. But if we tell them, how do we know you're telling the truth? Then we're actually doicha them biyadayim. They said an eidus and based in. How can we just go without any further evidence and go in and tell them that it may not be true and scare them into changing it? Ella oma ula, so rather ula says, no, we tell the defendant, yesh lecha eidim lazimam, do you have eidim that could make them eidim zimim? So that would be a way of saying in his defense to begin with. But Rabba says, what do you mean? How can you begin with something that would be a schus for him? It would be a choiva for them. If it turns out they're Adam Zimmerman, they're going to be chayv misa. So what good does that do? You're going to have Yankel is on trial over here for being Mechalel Shabbos, let's say. You're going to have Reuven and Shimon come and say that he was Mechalel Shabbos. We're going to say to Yankel, do you have other Edim that are going to make Reuven and Shimon Edim Zimin? And if it turns out that they do, Reuven and Shimon are going to get executed. How is that any better? We're saying something. We're trying to save Yankel, but meanwhile we're doing that to them. The Gemara says, why? What's the problem? So that wouldn't be to their detriment. We learn in a Mishnah in Makkos, Ein Edim Zemin Narogen Ad Shigomer Adin. The fact is, the Edim Zemin can't be executed unless the Gemar Din was based on their testimony. So if during the trial, before the Gemar Din, if other Edim come and say, Imanu Hayisim, nothing happens to the first Edim. Only after the Gemar Din, and before the execution, by the way, we also have the concept Kasha Zaman Volei Kasha Osa, as we're going to talk about in Masech to Makkos, and we'll talk about the reason behind that. Reasons, rather, behind it. But in any case, the point is that, yeah, if during the actual trial, the other Edim come and say, Mono Hayisim, nothing happens to the first Edim. Only if after Gmar Din, before the actual execution, if other Edim come and say, Mono Hayisim, then the first set are killed. So then in that case, how is it L'choiva for them? So that's the problem. We're saying to Yankel, do you have Edim? Fine, if he has Edim in his defense that can say Imanu HaYisim, they'll come in, they'll say Imanu HaYisim. Nothing's going to happen to the first set because before Gmar Din. So what's the problem? Then we've covered all our bases. We've said something L'schus for him that's not L'choiva for them. The end of Gemara answers to the Gemara says, but still, what if Taka Yankel doesn't do anything until the Gemar Din, or Maisi Edim, and then he brings his Edim Umazim Lahu, and then he makes him Edim Zemin, then it comes out by inviting him to begin with, do you have Edim? Then it comes out that we've said something that ends up being for the Choiva of them. So how could we do that? Ela Omar Rabba Aminon Lei. So rather, Rabba says, no, here's what we do. We tell him, Yesh Lecha Edim Lachishon. Do you maybe have Edim to contradict them? Now, Hazama would be where the other Edim come and say, Imanu Hayisim. You were with us in when you say this happened. Meaning, you have to realize by Hazama, the second Edim are not saying it's the second Edim are not saying that Yankel was not Mechal Shabbos, so he didn't kill Pliny or whatever. Yeah. They're saying maybe he was Mechal Shabbos, maybe he killed Pliny. We don't know, but you can't say that he did because you were with us elsewhere. As opposed to Akkosha would be, for example, we say, we know that Yanko couldn't have done this because he was with us someplace else. That would be Akkosha, not Hazama. Okay, so here. Reuven and Shimon come to Beis Din and they say, we saw Yanko, we saw on Shabbos Parshas Shmos, Yanko turned on a light and that makes him Chayev Skila. Now, there's two possibilities. Two other Edim can come and say, how could you say that Yankel did that in Crown Heights on Shabbos Parshas Shmos when he was with us in California on Shabbos Parshas Shmos? That's called Hakosha. Nothing in that case happens to the first two Edim. Really, what we say is, in other words, we say we don't know which Edim to believe. So therefore, look, we can't convict Yankel, but we throw out the whole case.
We don't know the last two.
No. So Hazama would be something else. Hazama is where the second Edim come and say, listen, maybe Yankel turned on that light on Shabbos in Crown Heights, but maybe he didn't. We don't know. But you are saying that you saw him doing it in Crown Heights, but you yourselves were with us in California elsewhere. That's called Hazama. That's where the Torah tells us Vasisim Lekash Zomam, that the first Edom got the punishment that they wanted to give to cause to Yankel. So now, therefore, so if Beis Din were to tell Yankel, do you have Edom to be mazim them, that's a problem. Because to be mazim them implies that you might cause that these first two Edom are going to be killed. But if you tell him, do you have Edom to be machish them? Do you have Edom, for example, that you were in California on that Shabbos? Then that would be fine, because that's not going to cause the first Edom to get punished. We're just going to say, okay, Beis Din is going to say, look, we have two Edom that say that he was in Crown Heights on that Shabbos. We have two other Edom that say he was in California on that Shabbos. So we don't know, so therefore let's just throw out the whole case.
And when I talk about we talk about the all witnesses we're talking here.
No, we're talking about the two sets of witnesses.
Yeah, we're not talking about the actual, where it actually happened.
Yeah. Well, they have to say where it actually happened.
Right, but there's not one Edom is not saying, no, it happened.
No, within each pair of Edom, one set of Edom say it was in New York, and the other pair of Edom say it was in California, that he was in California, or you were with us. Okay, so that's how we can do it. We can tell him that, do you have Edom to be machish them? That won't cause them to get punished, but it is a way of saying, to begin with, well, you know what? We're inviting you to bring Edom that will show that you're innocent, after all. That's one answer. Omer Rav Kahana, Rav Kahana Omer, Rav Kahana gives another answer. They can say, the opening statement in Beis Din will be, Midivreichem nizdaka Ploini. You know what? Based on what you're saying, it sounds like Ploini is innocent. So in other words, we're not saying you're saying something wrong, but they're saying, you know what? We hear what you have to say. It sounds like at first glance, that would be that he's innocent. Now, afterwards, we'll cross-examine you and we'll find out whether, in fact, it remains that way. But we're starting with a statement of schus. Another possibility, Abaye v'Rama d'Ami Tavayu, Amrin and Lay, what it is based and tells the person, the defendant himself, Ila katalta loy tidchal, if you didn't actually kill or do whatever Avera it is that they're accusing you of, then don't be afraid. So in other words, we tell him, look, you must be afraid, you have two Edom coming and saying that you did such and such, but we start with a statement telling him, you know what, if Yitaka didn't do it, you have nothing to be afraid of, because we'll find out the truth. So that's a statement in his favor, and then afterwards we'll go and start the cross-examination and figure everything out. Rav Ashi Omar, Rav Ashi says there's another possibility. They can say, they can announce anybody who knows something by which we can exonerate this aid should come and state that. That would be the opening statement. Keep in mind, that could be a lot of things. It could be, for example, other Edom again who come and say that these Edom themselves were elsewhere, which would make them Edom Zoymin. It could be Edom that come and say that Yankel himself, the defendant, was someplace else. It could be, for example, let's say Edom that come and say, as we learned in the previous parak, that Edom can't be Bali Avera or relatives if they are their Pasul Edus. So imagine you could have other Edom that come and say, you know what, you guys can't be validly giving testimony against Yankel because both of you are Masachke Bekovia, both of you are gamblers or Mafricha Yonim or any of the other things that we mentioned over there. Okay. Tanya Kavaseda Abaye v'Rava. Now, of all these opinions, we learn a Braisa that agrees with Abaye and Rava, like Abaye and Rava. Rebbe Omer, that Rebbe says, when we have a Soita, so this is the Kohen makes an initial statement to the Soita. He tells him, "Im lois shachav ishoisach." If no man has lain with you, v'im lois sotis v'gomer. And if you haven't gone astray, why do we start with that? Mikan shapoischin b'din in afoshes chilul l'schus. From here, we learn that when it comes to din in afoshes, we have to start with a statement in favor of him. So that's the kind of thing. By the same way as Abaye and Rava are saying, we tell the defendant, if you didn't actually kill, you have nothing to worry about. The same way, we learn that from the fact that the kohen is saying to the woman, if you didn't actually commit adultery, then you have nothing to worry about. So we see that Braisa agrees with them, and therefore that's taka the statement that the Dayanim should be saying to him as the initial statement when the case is being brought to Beis Din.
And this is ultimate.
This is all part of the poskim l'schus. By starting with a statement in his favor, that way we're showing that our aim as the Beis Din is to try and exonerate him if at all possible. And that's one of the 10 differences that we said between Din and Mominus and Din and Afoshis, where by Din and Afoshis we have to go that extra mile to do everything we can to exonerate him. So part of that is making that first statement, l'schus, and therefore, and then from there we'll continue. Obviously, we may find out l'choiva eventually, but at least this way we start with the assumption that there is schus over here, and we're going to go and try to find it if it's available.
And this we all.